And welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, and hoping you're having a wonderful day. And we're excited to bring you on another program talking about health, wellness, issues in alternative medicine, mind-body medicine, and other very interesting topics. And we have a guest today. We have an author, and his name is Will Johnson. And Will Johnson is going to be talking about his book, which is called Breathing Through the Whole Body, The Buddha's Instructions on Integrating Mind, Body, and Breath. So that's going to be what we're going to be talking about today. Now, Will Johnson is an author of several books, like the book today. And, of course, he's also written The Posture of Meditation, The Sailfish and the Sacred Mountain, and an award-winning book, The Spiritual Practices of Rumi, the famous Sufi poet. He's also the founder and director of the Institute for Embodiment Training in British Columbia, BC, Canada. And he has a BA in art and archaeology. And he worked as an art critic, and then he moved to the West Coast, and he became a Buddhist practitioner and Ralpher. And he started this whole new thing called embodiment training, which we're going to talk about that today. And we have a very interesting program together. So, Will, are you there?
I'm here. Nice to talk to you. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, great. I'm looking forward to our conversation. Tell us, let's really dumb it down for in the beginning here. Let's talk a little bit about just Buddhism in general and, of course, meditation in general. And then we'll get more specific on your particular aspect of it.
Sure. What I can say is that, Buddhism is not so much a religion in the way we conventionally know religions. It's more a path, a set of teachings that any individual can involve themselves in, and through going through basic kinds of exercises and the most basic one is sitting meditation in the Buddhist tradition. By doing specific exercises like sitting meditation practices, perhaps breath practices, one experiences a shift in their awareness of just what it is to, be here alive on the planet right now. And, the Buddhist fundamental perspective was that, living the life the way that we're living it, there's just so much challenge, even 2,500 years ago. So much unsatisfactoriness. Things happen, we don't want them to happen. I mean, that certainly happened to many of us over the last number of years in particular. Other things happen, we want them to happen, but then they leave. There's so much fundamental dissatisfactoriness, and he was able to view this condition and come up with some basic fundamental techniques, exercises really, that we can all participate in and practice, and through them we experience this kind of shift where it's not necessarily that the things that bother us aren't there anymore, but maybe they don't bother us as much. And I've been, ever since I was a kid, I've been very, very drawn to the nature of this this alternative dimension of being in the bottom line is that it just feels better there.
Yeah. Well, that talk segues us into meditation in general. There's so many different ways to do it and techniques and whatnot. But what's the commonality amongst all forms of meditation?
Yeah, and it's an interesting question. And the commonality is actually the sitting posture itself. I'm certainly talking about sitting meditation practices. And, as you're alluding to, there's just a vast array of techniques out there. There are techniques, breathing techniques. We'll be talking about some of them today. But some of them just stay with watching the breath as it enters and leaves the nostrils, or watching the belly as it rises and falls. Other schools will work with chanting. Other schools will work with letting go of the contents of the mind or watching the contents of the mind. Other schools will work with paying attention to the sensations of the body. In Japan, there are schools that work with trying to grapple with a totally insoluble question, and yet you have to come up with some kind of answer, at least a response. So if someone who is unfamiliar with, you know, all these different techniques of meditation were to come into a room where everybody is sitting doing their practice, and that person perhaps who came in the room, you know, wasn't that familiar with all the different forms of the varieties of practice, he or she would probably say that everybody is doing the same thing. And, over the years, as I started becoming involved in Buddhist practice, and then, you know, the other side of my background, I became very involved in Western somatic practices. I was trained as a Rolfer quite some time ago. It simply became clear that this actual act of sitting was really what the practice was all about. What we're doing is sitting down, letting go of, you know, the impulses to fidget and move and just, you know, relax for an extended period of time. And sometimes I think that the specific techniques are simply strategies to get people to sit down and, in a sense, relax, feel their bodies, open to the breath.
So how could patients, you know, watch their breath? What does that actually mean by watching it?
Yeah, that too is an interesting question, because it's not so much that we're a separate, you know, somewhat distant, objective observer of a phenomenon that's separate from us, because we are the breath. And yet in the beginning, probably when, anybody, whether a meditation student or someone who's perhaps been prescribed to practice mindfulness techniques as, an adjunct and support for their health. Whenever we first are told to, okay, just start observing the breath, it is almost as though we're viewing an object outside of ourselves. And that's where it begins. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, breath is such an automatic function. We very rarely pay it any attention. And certainly the breathing patterns of even tightly held, restricted bodies provide enough oxygen to keep us alive, right? But what we can, then do is, first of all, okay, locate the breath, start observing it, and in other words, become more conscious of this ordinarily very, very deeply unconscious function. And that's the initial stages of observation. But then, if you go deeper and deeper and you get, you know, more and more refined and sophisticated in your observation of the breath, you start realizing it's not really an object separate from ourselves. It is, in fact, it emanates from the very center of our center. And one progressively can, pass through stages of sophistication in their sensitivity to the awareness of breath, where it goes deeper and deeper, and suddenly we come, and I know I'm jumping the gun here a bit because we'll be talking about the book Breathing Through the Whole Body, but somewhat later. But you get to that kind of place where you realize breath and body are not separate.
Right, like the breath. I mean, as far as I've been schooled in many forms of meditation as well, and the thoughts, the mind sort of follows the breath. I think that's kind of what the link is for listeners maybe out there, is they might have, I've heard it said the mind is like a drunken monkey.
Right.
All over the place.
All over the place. And go ahead and finish your thought.
I was just going to say that and being all over the place, a way to allow it to come to a more restful state.
Yes,
is to focus on the breath, because the breath sort of the thoughts will mirror the breath.
You know,
can you
very
expand
much
on that?
So. Yeah, very much so. And I mean, this gets fascinating. There's lots of different levels that we can talk about here. But what I observe out in the world, how most of us are living, is within what I call a disembodied consciousness. we're identified with this monkey mind, the thoughts that are going all over the place. We're actually identified with that. The speaker of those monkey mind thoughts, of the, you know, the interior monologue of the mind, we all have the same name for that speaker. We call that person I. So we're identified with these thoughts. And what also accompanies a great deal of unconscious thinking and an identification with that process is an almost total absence of awareness of the palpable physical presence of the body. And what I'm getting at here is that on every part of the body, down to the smallest cell, there are sensations of one variety or another. And we can, you know, we can feel them as little blips or pinpricks of sensation. Some people will feel, you know, may call them energy or streaming or, you know, vibration. But these sensations exist on every part of the body down to the smallest cell, and very, very rarely are we ever aware of them. So when we have a great deal of thought going on, we are not present in body. And, you know, so much of, for me, the, you know, the process of meditation is to become present. You know, thoughts are generally always all about the past or the future. You know, when we are lost in thought, we are not present in body. And, you know, oftentimes when we're lost in thought, we're not really seeing the visual field in front of us. We're perhaps not hearing the sounds that are, you know, here to be heard in the immediate environment. And we are certainly not feeling the sensations of the body. So, you know, in a sense, you know, the practice of meditation is really to come present, and breath is such a wonderful object of meditation because it's with us all the time.
Yeah, you know, it's our portable, it's portable.
It's free.
It's free,
portable.
Too, Will.
it's free, it costs nothing, and it offers very, very rich rewards for, you know, those of us who decide to, you know, maybe start taking this force that really is what sustains us in our lives. You know, we can go without food for quite some time. We can go without water for many, many days. We go without breath for a couple of minutes, and our, you know, our lives are over.
And you know, that kind of puts it in perspective of how important it is. And so, tying this in with your book, Breathing Through the Whole Body, tell us a little bit about not only why you chose to write the book, but why you chose that title.
Okay. I've been obsessed by a passage in an early Buddhist a text called the Satipatthana Sutta. And this is a very, very early text, and the words are attributed to the historical Buddha himself. I've been obsessed with this text for probably about 30 years. And what always fascinated me about this is these are the Buddha's instructions on just exactly what we're talking about. How do you bring breath to more awareness in such a way that we can maybe undergo this kind of shift in awareness of self, in who we are and what we are, and find ways to settle out that monkey mind, perhaps even dissolve it. Okay, and there's a series of steps there that he talks about, and it begins with, just as we were speaking of a few minutes ago, the notion that you want to begin by observing the breath. And in this particular text, they say at the front of the body. So many meditation techniques will have you focus on breath as it enters or leaves and leaves the nostrils, or some of them will have you look at the belly wall, the front belly wall, as it rises and falls. What fascinated me about the text, however, is that it doesn't stop there. The ensuing instructions really talk about becoming much more refined in your awareness of breath, you know, being able to differentiate, being able to observe the subtleties, the nuances. And then it culminates in what was for me an altogether remarkable expression, the final instruction on this passage of breath awareness is, as you breathe in through the whole body. As you breathe out through the whole body. So, you know, the title of the book, you know, certainly comes, you know, right from that, you know, passage. It reflects this fascination I've had, well, really it's probably for the last 40 years now, of relating body to meditational experience and practice. And again, from an earlier age, mostly what I saw was that many of the spiritual traditions would tend to want to leapfrog over the body, that the body was looked upon as some kind of obstacle or impediment to the practice, that we have to get beyond the body to some kind of ultimate condition. And I just never found that appealing, and beyond which I never found that it worked particularly well. And I did get fascinated with, you know, awakening, this awareness of bodily sensation. You know, these sensations exist on every part of our body, down to the smallest cell, all the time. Why don't we feel them?
Well, I think people do feel them, but they try to numb themselves out to many. I mean, let's take pain, for example, you know, tie it into health.
Okay.
When people have pain, most of the times they don't want to feel the pain. They want to numb it out and go about their existence, yet in many practices, becoming present with that pain and exploring it and getting into it and seeing, acknowledging it, oftentimes is a great step towards dealing with it finally.
You know, it is a great step towards dealing with it, and there are many occasions when it's a great step towards actually dissolving it.
Right.
And if that doesn't occur, it's also a great step towards, in a sense, accommodating it and accepting it as a part of one's life. That certainly only if something like that is going to change, it will change through our willingness to embrace it and accept it. I'm not talking about glorifying it,
right,
or, you know, making it bigger, but giving ourselves permission just to feel it, you know, as it is, because it is a part of our experience in this present moment. And to the degree that we can do that, that gives us the best chance of resolving the kinds of physical or perhaps mental issues that are at the core of that kind of that kind of pain. And yes, it's true, most of us numb ourselves out. We block out. It's not only the blocking out of the awareness of pain. That's understandable. You know what's a little bit less understandable is that what we also block out is there was a Czechoslovakian writer, Milan Kundera. He wrote a book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. I always loved that title because we numb that out too. It's as though kindling an awareness of body is this unified field of shimmering tactile presence, and I'm not talking about creating this or manufacturing it or thinking about it as a platitude. We're not pulling bunnies out of a hat. I'm talking about just giving ourselves permission to actually feel every little part of the body, every little sensation from head to foot all at once as a unified field. You know, to the degree that we do that, that sometimes opens these other dimensions of awareness that are extraordinarily wholesome, extraordinarily healthful, and yet they're unwittingly, viewed as somewhat taboo.
Does that distract the mind,
yeah.
Will?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Does that distract the mind from... Well, let's go back to, the whole thing with meditation and... In many Buddhist schools, they concentrate on different parts of the body, or they allow the sensations to come, but they don't get locked into it, and then they'll pass too. You're saying to allow these things to come up and don't get attached to them, or don't isolate them.
Well, everything is changing, constantly, so we can't grab hold of anything. And, sometimes for people who have done, long, retreats in some of the different traditions, we'll find that it's very much like a roller coaster. There are days when you feel like you've gone to heaven, and then you think that's great, and then the next day it's that, you're on the other side of the fence.
Mm-hmm.
So that happens. One thing that I think you were starting to, talk about is saying distracting the mind, where I went to, and I just heard that phrase, what's interesting about kindling an awareness of the body as sensation is actually a lived, vibratory feeling experience, that quality of bodily presence, you can't be lost in your mind. When, you know, it's kind of like a teeter-totter. When you're lost in your mind, when there's a great deal of mental monkey mind going on, that's like the teeter-totter elevated, and the other side of that, the body, there'll be no awareness. It'll be numbed out. You won't, you'll blocked it out. Now you shift the teeter-totter and you start giving yourself permission to let the sensations of the body come forward, to kindle an awareness of body as actual lived experience. And when you know the whole body can be sensationalized in that way, it's as though someone's just pulled a plug on the monkey mind. It simply shuts off. So that was one of the early observations that meant a great deal to me, and then started, I guess, in a sense, keeping on guiding me on this path.
Now, so, you know, I mean, there's some meditation that involves moving, like in, you know, Tai Chi and whatnot, but you had said in, I think, some of your questions in the book, something about that most meditation involves sitting, and I think you even mentioned that Buddha himself said that you're supposed to sit upright, and he felt that was very important. So how do we get from, you know, these moving forms of meditation and Qigong and types of things like that, and then we look at the Buddhist tradition and they're kind of sitting very still?
Yes, yeah, and, you know, before I, you know, get into that, you know, the world of meditational experience and practice, I mean, it runs the gamut.
Right.
From, you know, you have the what could arguably be called the passive pole of meditational inquiry, which is sitting meditation, okay? But then you have all the active forms, the spontaneous movement and dance forms, the traditional martial arts forms, the hatha yoga, forms. Now, in some ways, I'm something of a fanatic for balance, because we'll talk about that with this upright spine in a second. But, you know, for me, it feels very, very important to, in a sense, embrace both within your spiritual practice. So to have, practices of sitting meditation where you're not really moving very much, but, you know, take what I just said as a caveat, and we'll talk about that in a second, to practices of ecstatic dance, you know, spontaneous movement where everything is, is opening and moving. Now, what's interesting, this notion of breathing through the whole body is totally applicable to either end of the spectrum of those, of the movement spectrum of meditational experience. Talking about just sitting practices on their own, they have an unwitting tendency to become too still. And what I mean by that is that they have the tendency to become frozen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're doing spontaneous movement and ecstatic dance, everything's going to keep moving, right? You know, you're not going to be faced with that kind of issue. But it's all too easy for people who enter into different kinds of sitting meditation practices, Buddhist practices, to sit down and we're not supposed to move a muscle and get too frozen. And this is, you know, an issue that is, you know, that I believe holds the key to that statement in the Buddhist text of how does one actually breathe through the whole body. You know, Dr. Z, when I sit in front of a group of, you know, sitting meditators, and I look out on everybody, and, you know, everybody's sitting, doing the practice, you know, very, very wonderful, good-hearted, sincere people are, you know, drawn to these, to these practices. The most common thing, however, that I see is that everybody is sitting almost hyper still, as though, you know, we have the idea that the goal of the practice is to become like a stone garden statue of the Buddha. And this kind of freezing of the body and holding still, this is, from my perspective now, what, you know, needs to let go so that we can start experiencing a breath that's going to actually pass through the whole body. Now, you know, you take the force that causes waves to form in the ocean, okay? You know, whatever this force is, it's generated, and the body of water through which it passes is very relaxed and malleable, and the wave just moves through. Mm-hmm. We could be creating a similar situation with breath as it moves through the, you know, the body, and especially in terms of a focused meditation practice. As we sit, we come upright because this upright posture allows us to relax and let go, allows us to drop the weight of our body without falling over, right? And to the degree that we're able to do that, we can start surrendering. You know, it goes beyond observing. First of all, it's locating the breath, then it's observing it, but then it really becomes surrendering to it, and in a sense, kind of merging with it. But surrendering to this force, you know, the diaphragm, you know, contracts as the breath comes in. That's like the force that causes the wave to appear and move through the body of water. Well, in a truly relaxed body, there that can, that striking force, the diaphragm, can, it can set up a chain reaction through all the joints in the body, and there can be subtle motion, very amoeba-like. So on the inhalation, click, click, click through all the joints of the body. An opening, a lengthening, a beaming out perhaps. On the exhale, it moves back down, but it's constantly in motion. And my understanding at this point, you know, simply as a, you know, a practitioner, you know, just doing the practices and then, you know, sharing them as I do, is that, you know, the ability to relax in such a deep way that allows this breath to start, you know, moving through every joint of the body, causing subtle motions. You know, the person who's walking in, remember, we talked about the person walking in and they couldn't tell what kind of practice everybody was doing. That person would walk in and they wouldn't see that this person was necessarily not, you know, doing the practice or wasn't still in their practice. But, you know, stillness is a value. In meditation, it only refers to the quieting of the monkey mind. It cannot refer to a freezing of the physical body. You freeze the physical body, and you just jam up this force of the breath, and it often spills over and out and manifests as more monkey mind.
Well, even if the breath gets, even if the body is frozen, and if people aren't even focusing on the breath, there are other rhythms in the body that they could feel. Like I do a lot of cranial sacral therapy on people.
Right.
I could feel the ebb and flow of this fluid. You were talking about the breath kind of running through the body like that. So I'm trying to imagine, how can I, you know, teach that to patients? And then I know that they can feel, or other practitioners that I've trained in cranial sacral can feel the cranial sacral rhythm. So it's probably similar to that. Like, how do you feel your breath in your feet? How do you feel your breath in your knees and your toes?
Yeah, and on top of that, feel, you know, the beating of the heart that's beating mm-hmm. like, you know, there's this huge drum in the middle of our body,
right.
and we don't generally feel that. And even as you're, you know, referring to, you know, perhaps the most subtle, this constant, you know, fluid motion of the cranial, you know, sacral rhythms, you know, all of this can be felt to the degree that we just simply keep relaxing and staying aware
yeah.
and staying present. And again, that's simply, you know, that's kind of the beginning and the end of the meditation practice, is just to, you know, sit down and we're aware as we, you know, as moments and moments pass, perhaps we become more aware. Perhaps the mind comes and steals away our awareness and we become less aware and we become more aware. But ultimately, over time, the body relaxes more and more and you can feel more and more of these you know, rhythms.
Wow.
You know, in part, and you know, I'm you know, very keen on as I'm sitting, also opening into this very, very subtle kind of fluid expansion and contraction that I'm guessing is, you know, this cranial, you know, sacral rhythm that, you know, you're speaking about. For me, it's a matter of, you know, letting go, and all of them, in a sense, coalesce. But, you know, just as, you know, we could block the awareness of that flow, expansion, contraction of the cranial sacral rhythm, we can certainly block any possibility of a breath actually having an ability to billow through the whole body, every joint of the body relaxed, because it will do that. If the body is not relaxed, you cannot, you know, experience this breath that will pass all the way through it. But, you know, there are so many of these things, but this is all, making, not even so much making peace with, but even opening up to.
Yeah.
The experience, the lived experience of body, and as I was saying earlier, we live in this primarily disembodied culture. We're on the teeter-totter. We're caught in our minds. And most of us, most of the time, have, frankly, virtually no awareness of, the physical presence of the body, let alone something as subtle as the cranial sacral rhythm, other than, we're, aware of heaviness or pain or numbness. That's mostly, unhappily, what we get. But that is the condition that the Buddha observed and said, okay, this is where most of us are living our lives. We want to let go and come out of this. We want to wake up out of whatever we're unconsciously doing to resist these most natural rhythms and flows. Does that make some sense?
Excellent. And I hear the music, so we need to take a quick break.
Okay.
And we're going to stay with that and stay with Progressive Radio Network, and we're going to continue with Will Johnson, author of Breathing Through the Whole Body, when we return after a few station IDs and public service announcements. Take care and stay with us. And we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamfro, naturopathic physician and host today. And we're having a really interesting conversation with author Will Johnson. And Will wrote a great book called Breathing Through the Whole Body, The Buddha's Instructions on Integrating Mind, Body, and Breath. And, Will, I was just reading in the book and some of the commentary, and you talk about the breath massaging and melting away tension and pain, and it would seem like the Buddha was talking about these things way back when. I mean, pain is a universal certainly phenomenon, that's for sure. But I'm curious, a lot of people when they, a lot of patients when they come to me as a practitioner, and you, of course, as a practitioner, and Ralph would know this more than anyone else, we hold a lot of psychic stress and emotional stress and other types of things like a hologram in the body. How can meditation and breathing through the whole body work to unlock these this holographic information in a positive and healing way?
Yeah. Again, all of us are unique, and one of the things that's unique about all of us is that we each have a unique way with which, for whatever reason, and from whatever source, we've learned how to inhibit, hold back, resist, and actually hold the breath. The breath is this life. This life force that's pulsing through in this moment, pulsing through in the, next moment. It just has to keep on, pulsing through us. But what we tend to do is lock ourselves in bodies that limit, the ability of, the breath to actually, move through the whole body. It doesn't necessarily get very far. We live in, frozen bodies, tense bodies. So, in a sense, the first You know, perhaps even though the only thing that you have to remember about meditation is that the goal of the practice is to relax. And it's all, that's sounds very glib, but know there are lots of instructions. There is Tibetan teacher Talopa from, I can't remember, it's the 11th through the 12th century, and he writes a text. He said, the only thing you're to do with your body is just to relax, just to keep relaxing. And what we're relaxing are literally these tensions, these holdings, these kind of kinks in the saran wrap, in a sense that sort of distort then how this vital energy manifests out into the world. So, in terms of, viewing, say, these instructions to breathe through the whole body as a meditation practice, one would be paying initially in the beginning, certainly, more attention to, I'm going to observe my body, right? In the same way we talked about initially observing the breath was just to locate it in one place, perhaps at the nostrils, but now I'm going to start observing my body, and I want to be able to pinpoint where I uniquely freeze.
Yeah,
I uniquely hold.
Well, the Chinese, the Chinese say that pain is frozen chi.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's like the energy is blocked there; it's frozen.
Yeah, exactly.
So this might be a great way to unblock this, freezing of the. Of the energy, beautifully said.
Yeah, absolutely, and to the degree that, the kinds of physical pains that we experience in, in the body, are, in a sense a, a function of that frozen quality, this holding back, frankly, on, the current of the life force. To, the degree that the source of pain comes from, is that kind of thing, we can start locating and pinpointing where in my body do I not move in when I breathe? What joint in my body is frozen when I breathe? So what, where am I holding back? And, just even take the spine, take the upright spine. The Buddha even says, sit down with your spine erect and upright. And the whole reason for that, we're just talking about, fundamental engineering and basic physics, that if you have a structure like a skyscraper that is, built on a vertical axis, the verticality of the structure is what provides it with its support. It doesn't have to grab on. It's not leaning out in ways, like the Leaning Tower of Pisa or something. That's just, the gravity is just going to weigh down. So we sit with this upright spine so that we can relax without toppling over. But then what's even as important to understand is that it's not only an upright spine, but it's a moving spine. And, the spinal column, what is it, something like 24 little individual vertebral bones, that we have, yes?
Yeah.
And the joints between the vertebral bones are not unlike joints anywhere else in the body. They're designed solely for the purpose of movement. So, one of the places that I'll work with meditation students is, paying attention, awakening an awareness of the body and, an awareness of breath. But then as one deepens, then start paying attention simply to the vertebrae in the spine, which ones aren't moving when we breathe. There can be subtle adjustments in camber and tilt and angle and distance from one another that can occur constantly on every single breath. Now, to the degree that we're starting to allow for the possibility that there can be this kind of movement, well, what starts happening is that we reintroduce the potential for movement at these stuck places in the body, and that is this kind of massaging force of the breath. You can actually feel it you know, moving into joints in the body that have, excuse me, become chronically frozen, and it almost feels like a body worker's hands, but from the, you know, from the inside out. You know, one to, you know, share with you, Dr. Z, is, you know, I understand how you, you know, you're very, you know, drawn to cranial, you know, sacral work. This was a piece of the puzzle that I always found fascinating. You know, just a bit of, you know, background. You know, it really wasn't up until a few hundred years ago that, you know, human beings on this planet understood what breath was even for. That, you know, the predominant understanding of, you know, of breath, certainly in our Western worlds, you know, we won't talk about the Eastern meditational worlds that certainly became involved in the experience of breath, but with the Western worlds, trying to figure out what, you know, breath was for, the predominant idea was that breath was somehow to cool the heat of the heart. And it's interesting because if you pay attention to breath at your nostrils, you, one of the things that you notice is when it comes in, it's kind of cool, and when it goes off, it's kind of hot, just as, you know, you'd expect if that were the function of breath. But, you know, we know now what breath does. There is a very, very fascinating Swedish teacher named Emanuel Swedenborg. And, you know, again, I'm not sure. I believe he's from the 18th century. I'm not entirely sure about this. He, as an early Westerner, was very drawn to these breath practices. And this, to me, was always very fascinating. His thought on why we breathe, the function of breath and its purpose, was to keep the spinal column in constant motion, to pump the spinal fluid. Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, you may, you know, you as a cranial sacral therapist may, you know, may certainly know of that. But that was always extremely fascinating to me. And to the degree that we allow, you know, the breath to move through the body, it does. Sometimes it actually feels like from the inside out, someone is massaging into these formerly very stuck, held, frozen places in the body.
Well, you know, when these things get like frozen, like I mentioned, as you with a background in Rolfing know about, people trap illnesses and things almost go from the etheric thought into the physical manifestation of, like you said, frozen and then pain and then lack of a flow of the chi, and then the blood becomes and the lymph gets stuck, and then that leads to frank illness on the gross level. So we go from the subtle level of being stuck to the gross level where I could see it on an x-ray, they're developing osteoarthritis or something like that.
Yeah, and you know, and again, you know, we get into these stuck places, and the stuck places, they literally don't move. And you know, I like, you know, how you've voiced that, you know, sometimes things happen in our life, and then the next thing we know, it's as though they take form in the physical flesh. There are you know, painful reactions that we have in our lives, and we freeze, and we, in a sense, impound them, you know, literally darn them down into, you know, into the flesh, and it gets more held and more still. So you can then develop things like, you know, all of the, you know, the illnesses that, you know, frankly, enshrine lack of motion.
And well, some people can't, you know, I was thinking about a couple patients that said, I can't meditate because I can't sit still. When I sit still, I'm so fibromyalgic that my muscles cry.
Yeah.
My muscles cry to move, and I get restless. As, I don't know if you know a lot about homeopathy, but it's kind of the Roostock state where you have to constantly stretch and move. Now, well, what you're basically saying is that's okay when you're meditating.
Absolutely.
The movement.
Absolutely. If, you know, to the degree that one is, you know, really letting go.
Yeah.
Really relaxing, and also then, well, okay, a couple of the preconditions. One, you have to be playing with upright balance. You can't be kind of slumped over or overly rigid, because both of those will block out the awareness of the body and, you know, the flow of you know, the key energy as well. So if you're able to sit, you know, and do you remember when you were a kid and you went and took a broom and balanced it upside down on your finger?
Sure.
You remember that? And there was that, always that magic moment. Well, that's this vertical axis. You know, that's, in a sense, that's the image that I'll often use sometimes for my upper body when I'm sitting. And it's constantly moving. It's not fixed, right? But there is that place of upright balance. It, you just, you let go. I felt very powerful as a kid, you know, when that would happen, right? But you have this upright, that allows you to let go. That allows the sensations of the body to come out of hiding. And through the relaxation, then the motion, the amoeba-like motion of body, can start coming back into your experience. And you do, in my experience, you very much ride that on the, you know, the breath in particular. And when body starts breathing in this way, in other words, there's an awareness of the whole of the body as this unified field of tactile presence. It's feeling full, head to foot, nothing left out, right? That's there, and then there's this amoeba-like motion surrendering to the breath. Something happens at the level of the mind. You know, the monkey mind, as I said earlier, it's like someone pulls the plug or it just starts fading. And then there are these other dimensions of consciousness, I guess, of experience of what's real, of what this is to be alive as human being, that can start emerging, you know, once that, you know, that, you know, blanket of the monkey mind, that veil of the mind starts, you know, starts lifting a bit.
Well, you had said that the mind is addicted to thinking, which I found quite humorous. I highlighted it in...
Yeah,
and I thought that was interesting because I mean it sounds kind of like a pun, but at the same time it's there is an addiction to thinking, and people sometimes think so much. And I know in you know, the Indian tradition, there are different constitutions or doshas, and when everyone has different types of thinking, like a person who has a vata disorder will be more on the worry or anxious kind of thinking. Well, what if this, what if that? People that are pitta energies will think angry thoughts, frustrated
right.
thoughts. And then kapha people really have a hard time getting moving. They might feel depressed or gloomy thoughts. So,
yeah.
You know, so... Even and you know that kind of ties into, you know, Buddhism, certainly from an Indian tradition.
Well, with setting. Every one of those you know, those conditions, they're called doses.
The dosha.
Dosha. Yeah. With every one of those, there are going to be particular you know, postural, structural patterns of holding still in the body.
Yeah.
And, you know, they may each of them be different, but they will all ultimately have the same effect of disallowing this motion of breath that could move through the body in the same way that, you know, the force that causes waves in the ocean can move effortlessly through a body of water. I mean, we could never think of a wave suddenly freezing and not, you know, moving at some point, right?
Well, I mean, the thing that I like about these ancient things, Will, is that these ancient disciplines is that unlike modern medicine and they would actually, the ancient practitioners, and of course they were, you know, contemporaries of Buddha, of course, they would actually prescribe certain breathing, certain thinking practices, of course, you know, diet and lifestyle and all different things to allow people to change their you know, illnesses and their mind, body, and actually a blueprint for healthy living. So what I like about it is they would actually prescribe a certain way of breathing. And it's
yeah.
kind of like what your book, like, you know,
yeah.
they would prescribe these things as part of medicine. Of course, being a physician, to me that's fascinating that that, you know, in modern medicine, they're not doing that. They're just prescribing external things.
Not at all. Yeah.
You know, they're prescribing herbs, you know, which is okay, and homeopathics, okay, a little bit more on the energetic level.
Yeah.
But, you know, these gross things that try to change the physiology instead of looking at the breath and things like that.
Yeah, well, exactly. And, you know, the difference that we're talking about is a way of, you know, approaching just how to live a wholesome life.
Mm-hmm.
From the perspective, okay, I get it. There isn't any magic pill out there
that
anybody's made that I can just take, and I'm just going to feel, you know, great all the time. Although, you know, the pharmaceutical companies come up with these mood altering kinds of kinds of drugs that, you know, have their place and are probably grossly and widely abused. Okay, and a whole other way of maybe approaching this is, okay, I have to take responsibility. Oh, I get it. I've been living in a way where I've been resisting and holding back on the most fundamental, basic current of the life force. You know, my very essence, my nature. Okay, I see. I am going to have to then start find some practices. What can I do that can start melting that, that can start dissolving that, so that we can start, you know, softening the rigidities, you know, within, very, very, you know, deeply within. And this is, to me, the taking on of spiritual disciplines and practices. It's all about self-healing.
Now, you have a website that, I'm just looking at the time. We only have a few more minutes. You have a website associated with other of your teachings and books and things like that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, my website is www.embodiment.net. And, you know, what we were saying earlier, yes, sitting meditation practices are very, very important to me. It's, in a sense, the passive pole of the practices, because I also have become very, very involved over the years is when I started awakening to my body, when I started waking up and started feeling actually this, you know, these sensations, these energies, you know, the body opens, and often, you know, I opened into the whole world of spontaneous movement and dance, and got very involved in the, you know, the writings of Rumi. And early on, I stumbled upon a very, very powerful gazing practice. Do people sit down and hold each other's gaze and just start letting go? And it turns out that that, again, is the main practice that the great mystic and poet and the originator of the dance of the whirling dervish, Rumi, was exploring with his great friend Sham. So the practices that I do, you know, run the gamut from somewhat passive, mostly eyes closed, sitting meditation, to opening the body, just letting go. And, you know, music is my friend, to interactive practices where two friends come together, sit down, and hold each other's gaze and dissolve into what is healing about that form of practice.
Well, thanks, Will. I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this. Breathing through the whole body, the Buddha's instructions on integrating mind, body, and breath. Will Johnson, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, you too, Dr. Z. Take care.
Okay, have a great one.
You will.
And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Stay tuned right here to Progressive Radio Network, your source for cutting-edge information. Take care and have a healthy day. Bye-bye.